Welcome to McGuffin Man. I'm Alex, and with me as usual is James. You can check out our website, themcguffinman.com, for all of our previous podcasts. We have recently discussed Con Air, Capote, Mother, Midnight Run, and American Vandal. Our next podcast will be about Dazed and Confused and Everybody Wants Some, which we have already recorded because we love manipulating time, just like Mr. Linklater. Yeah, just sort of push that a week because the American Vandal podcast is pretty good, so we wanted to let it sit there a little bit. So yeah, themcguffinman.com.
Welcome to the MacGuffin Men. And now, here are Alex and James.
James.
Yep.
We are here, and we are podcasting.
We are.
Extreme close-up of an ear, putting an earbud in. And here we are.
Yeah, we're here. Podcast, 35 years in the making.
A podcast older than both of us.
That's right. Yeah, we're talking
about Gattaca.
No, we did see those letters, though. We're talking about Blade Runner 2049.
Yes. Yeah, so I realized I didn't mention this before the podcast. I think we should spend like 2 minutes talking about the first Blade Runner, because I feel like the amount of time we've spent talking about Blade Runner in the many years of our friendship has sort of established it as a second language, and I think we kind of need to set it as a baseline. Okay. Because that's something baseline. That's something we will totally skim over and expect everybody to understand that we both have conflicted opinions on the first Blade Runner.
Have we not done a Blade Runner podcast?
We have, but like years ago, you know?
Yeah.
Nobody is digging in our archives, my friend. Ryan Gosling is not going to meet that adorable baby and going through the MacGuffin Men archives.
The blackout that wiped out the first 200 MacGuffin Men episodes.
Yeah,
claimed exactly. The Blade Runner podcast exactly. As a victim.
R.I.P. But yeah, okay. I think we should just talk about that for a sec.
Yeah, okay. So, brief recap of our feelings about Blade Runner, I guess. Sure. A movie that we both, you said we have conflicted opinions on it. I think they're overwhelmingly positive. I was actually thinking about this. It's got a bit of the Christopher Nolan movie syndrome. Like it's very good, and then some things that just stand out like a sore thumb.
Yeah, it's the smart dumb movie.
Yeah, I'll say what I believe is true for both of us, and feel free to interject when I'm not speaking for you correctly, but it's a movie that we both appreciate. We obviously weren't alive when it came out, so we didn't really live through what it was like to be before and after Blade Runner, but it's a movie that had a big cult following, didn't make a lot, if any, money when it first came out. But
I think adjusted for inflation, its worldwide box office is $18 million.
Okay. So it's got a bit of the like a Velvet Underground kind of thing. It's maybe not a lot of people saw it at the time, but a lot of the people who went on to make films a generation later pointed to this as something that was very influential to them. And it's a weird movie, and it's one that I'll watch and have a hard time recommending to certain people. And it's just a very different movie, kind of blending some genres, and has a kind of storied history about production and release, but is kind of a singular work that's worth your time.
Yeah, absolutely. I agree with pretty much everything you said. The Velvet Underground comparison is very, very astute. Everybody that watched Blade Runner seemed to become a filmmaker, you know, or everybody that had a ticket in the theater, I guess.
Yeah.
But yeah, and I think something that is 100% worth pointing out is that most people know of the movie Blade Runner and or have seen it by this point. At least 50% of the people I know that have seen Blade Runner straight up hate it. You know, like it's, yeah. I totally understand that because it has some of the worst moments in a movie I love, you know, like there's just some bad corny stuff in it. It's clear that the editing, it's clear that it was a movie made under duress and that a lot of things were pieced together on the fly, which is not to say that that's automatically a bad way to make a movie. So I'm a huge Terrence Malick fan, and apparently he just whispers words into people's ears and tells them to go play in cornfields. But Blade Runner is just kind of like that. And I think in order to really love Blade Runner, and I think I am on, I don't know, most of those cult movies I love more than anybody. I am not at the upper end of Blade Runner, although I do love that movie. I think that movie is as good as you want it to be, because it never gives you any answers, but it gives you enough things to project yourself onto, or your own thoughts onto. And so that, like, depending on how hard you want to work at loving Blade Runner, you can love, anybody can love Blade Runner. But also, if you don't love Blade Runner, I get it 100%, you know?
Yeah, and I think that you and I, Alien, there are certain sci-fi movies that you and I really love, but we're not sci-fi people the way that a lot of sci-fi people are, right?
Yes, that is exactly correct.
And I think that's part of it. I mean, this is for people who read a ton of sci-fi and, you know, Asimov and watch Star Trek and, you know, just kind of live in a sci-fi world more than we do, even though some of those things I listed are things we both enjoy and have done. It seems to be like a big part for people who spend a lot of time in those genres, and we're simply not those people, even though we don't look down on those genres by any means. Like, I mean, Alien as an example, we both absolutely adore that movie and have tons of good things to say about it, and I'm sure there's more that I just can't think of right now, but we aren't as into that as other people are.
Yeah, no, exactly. We don't watch Star Trek, you know, like, I think that's a
that's a good line in the
That's sand. A brief summation. Like, we'll go see the Star Wars movies, but we will not watch your new Star Trek television show.
Yeah, yeah, that's right. So, or your fake Star Trek TV show, Seth MacFarlane.
I like sci-fi way more than I like Seth MacFarlane. Moving on. So, hard cut to 2049.
Hard cut to a different eyeball.
Yeah, exactly. Or what if it's the same eyeball?
Yeah, I guess we could ask a lot of those questions throughout that, but we'll talk about,
or we could ask what is an eyeball.
It's true. And I guess we could preface this, I mean, we haven't said Ridley Scott's name, which I think bears mentioning, the director,
much to my chagrin. No, I'm just kidding. Up until 1982, Ridley Scott was very cool. Sorry, I guess not 83. Blade Runner comes out in 82.
Yeah, counting Blade Runner. Yeah, and so we will say he was the director of the original, and I think for a time was attached to direct this, but
but then we all got lucky. He's so, yeah, like, old man Ridley Scott is just so lazy, and all of his movies look really flat now. This is not a podcast to talk about Ridley Scott, but if you want to do a podcast on The Martian and just listen to me complain for an hour, we can do that.
No, I will say that it sounded like there would be more money in him blowing open the Alien universe, which is what he has spent his time doing as of late. And this movie fell into the hands of Denis Villeneuve, whose movies we have talked about and who we've talked about as a director. And I think we were both excited to see this movie, generally liking the first one a lot and liking the previous works of this director, right?
Yes. I would say when the idea for a sequel to Blade Runner was announced, I would say cautious optimism is how I felt. When I heard Ridley Scott was directing it, I got less excited. And I think Alien Covenant from earlier this year is the perfect example of that sort of hesitation, because Alien Covenant really plays out like a Ridley Scott's greatest hits album. But then when Denis Villeneuve got attached, I was just excited because my boy Denis, you know, like, he's fantastic.
Yeah.
And then he's just continue to add pieces that I appreciate. Mr. Freaky Deaky himself, Roger Deakins, Ryan Gosling in his first blockbuster movie. Harrison Ford, never a problem with me, you know?
Yeah. So we've talked on other podcasts about these directors, you know, some of them young or up and coming or people who've shown a lot of promise, getting attached to sequels or franchises or bigger universes, which, I mean, it's obviously a direct sequel to Blade Runner, however people want to talk about how it may not be. It very much is that, even though I didn't think Blade Runner was ever going to get a sequel, but And again, I wasn't really clamoring for it either. And as we said, Villeneuve is a director we like, and you've kind of been apprehensive about these directors going to these big franchises instead of doing something big and newer and creative and original. So was it kind of pure excitement, or was it a bit abated knowing that this is basically 2 years of his life that he wouldn't be spending on something perhaps more personal and kind of dear to his heart and creative?
I mean, for most directors, it's 2 years. For Denis Villeneuve, it seems to somehow be 8 months. Nobody works faster than that guy. I think he just realizes he's on, like, I feel like he's got that whole, he didn't get to be able to do what he wanted as a director until he was in middle age, and now he's just sort of like, I can't believe they keep letting me do this. I can't believe it. Like, I literally spent a decade and a half to 2 decades sitting around thinking of how I would use this amount of money if I one day had it. So I've got to keep moving until they tell me I can't have money to make these movies anymore. So I would say initially it was definitely the cautious optimism of, I think Rian Johnson making a Star Wars movie is the perfect example, right? Like, I wish it had been less than 5 years since the last Rian Johnson movie. But he's been working in the Star Wars universe for so long. But what I tell myself with those is that when Rian Johnson's done making Star Wars, he gets to make literally whatever he wants, because he will have been the director of, at worst, the second highest grossing movie of all time. my cautious optimism about Villeneuve would have been the same. I think that's partially out of ignorance, though, because I didn't know that the funding structure of this movie is a little bizarre. It's mostly financed by Alcon Entertainment. And this is sort of like them dipping their toe in the blockbuster waters. Like, this was a huge bet for them, but they are also more independent than studio. So I think had I known that going in, I would have understood the pacing and everything of the movie more than, like, the first time I was watching it, I was like, this is the slowest paced $150 million movie I've ever seen in my life, and I'm so on board with this. I think it just came from a place of ignorance. I was cautiously optimistic, but I'm happy that I was ignorant to understanding the funding structure, because I would have been way too excited if I understood that Denis Villeneuve was basically getting a blank check in Roger Deakins and the Blade Runner property. You know?
Yeah, and it was kind of funny when you're talking about the pace that he works at, because he's finally able to do what he wants. This is $150 million and a known intellectual property, and it clocks in at 2 hours and 45 minutes,
which is probably like realistically about 2.5 hours of actual movie and then 15 minutes of credits,
right? And yeah, I mean, pace the way that you said it is, a weird, like, two-person, six-handed sex scene in the middle that goes on for longer than it might in a different version of this movie.
Or a different version of this movie, that sex scene goes on for way longer. I think in a movie, or a version of this movie made by a studio, that scene doesn't end when the shirt comes off, you know?
Yeah, absolutely. It's not to say this movie doesn't have sexual content, but it's just a bit more abstract and weird.
Yeah, than, exactly.
Straightforward sexy that we would get in another one. So were you happy with this movie overall?
I would say it's like, it's weird. I remember because I had I saw it on a Thursday night screening in IMAX at like 11 p.m. because it was either that or I have to wait 6 days to see this movie, which I would have a real emotional struggle doing. So I had a weird experience, like, walking out of the theater at 2 a.m. with a bunch of Blade Runner fans that had just seen Blade Runner for the first time, because my screening was sold out and everybody was on the exact same page as me. Everybody's stone silent, with the exception of the guy next to me, who right as the movie was about to start said to his friend, "Yo, I'm so high." Which was fantastic. He was also super nice. He literally offered me a nacho at one point. But and like everybody's sort of walking out in this haze at 2 a.m. and I just, like, my initial review of it, how I felt leaving the theater, was like, that was that was more Blade Runner than Blade Runner. Like, it just felt, it felt exactly the same as how I felt watching Blade Runner. Like, there are some things that I was like, I don't know, could give it, take it or leave it. But the things that I liked so much. It was so beautiful. And as somebody that has been known to want to project different opinions of you know, a few of my opinions onto a movie, I found it very, very rewarding. And I think the number one thing I can say about this movie that really speaks to the indescribable sort of appeal that I think it has is that I've now seen it three times in pretty full theaters, or super full theaters twice, and then an okay full theater once. Stone silence the whole movie, you know, like nobody's talking, nothing. And it's like when it's loud, it's really loud, but when it's quiet, it's really quiet. And yeah. Like you just can't even hear rustling of popcorn bags. Like, it's amazing. And when you walk out of it, there is just this sort of, it feels like you've been through like a real experience, you know, just because you have been locked in this sort of pace, this deliberate pace, and the sound design is just so beautiful, and all of these things that are sort of imperceptible to most people, and I will say including myself, that just sort of end up giving you this feel of just sort of being, I don't know, being caught up in a movie. And then 2.5 hours have passed by, and then the synths get cranked up to 11, and you see Dirt directed by Denis Villeneuve, and you try and piece your mind back together, you know?
Yeah, it's pretty captivating for a slow movie, which, I mean, isn't impossible, obviously. Other people achieve this, but with the pacing that it has, if it's not, you know, if it doesn't grip you, it just drags, right?
Yes, exactly. I think it would just be like the same feel, again, more Blade Runner than Blade Runner. If you watch the first half hour of Blade Runner and you're like, I do not care for this, turn off the movie. It gets yeah. way worse before it gets better. The only part you will like is the cut to black on the elevator door. Yeah, so yes, I would agree. If you are not into this movie, you're going to hate this movie.
Yeah, and so
I want to know what you think about this movie.
Okay, sure, yeah. Yeah, I think that it was... I will say that I don't think it always grips me the way that it is supposed to. I think it does feel like a long movie, and you know, it is, and it's supposed to be, as we said, a bit of a slow burn, a captivating one, and I think it hits the mark most of the time, and I have problems with it, but overall I enjoyed it.
Yeah. I mean, at least Replicants learned what consent is. We can say that.
Yeah, I guess.
Yeah, that's a positive. Yes, no, I get that entirely. I just think and also the first time I saw it, I do remember like really feeling time passing, like you know, because they're like, Heat is a 3-hour movie. It's a perfect example of a 3-hour movie that does not feel like 3 hours, because that is the fastest paced goddamn movie in the world. But like Blade Runner, you really get to sort of sit there. Like most conversations, someone will say their line, and then someone waits like a full second to follow up. You know, like it's the anti Aaron Sorkin situation happening in Blade Runner. Yeah, you do really notice the time passing, but I just think that it's so worth it to feel, to again, feel this sort of indescribable feeling as you're walking out of a theater, of just sort of like feeling different from how you walked in. And, I mean, I saw it in the heart of downtown Toronto, and walking out at 2 a.m. and just seeing all this neon light everywhere is just a very odd experience, you know? Also, it was raining. Just all of these, like, very Blade Runner-y things, and you're just like, what the fuck is going on? I can't even imagine how the super stoned guy with the nachos next to me is dealing with this right now.
Yeah. And I will say, for those, I mean, we speak about... you know, the very deliberate slow pacing. It's obviously very grand in a lot of ways. You know, we have, you know, humans or replicant, you know, human-sized robots walking around among giant statues and skyscrapers, and some some very large rooms, making people look very small. Mm-hmm. And, you know, we're dealing with some pretty large questions about reality and life and the future of our society. Well, not our society necessarily, but the future of society and dystopia and kind of these very grand things. But I do think one of the things I do enjoy about it is how it does still feel personal. You know, it doesn't really feel like things are, you know, have to get out of the way, out of the scope of this movie. And I think it looks gorgeous, and I think it does feel big at times, but it never feels epic for the sake of being epic. And
100% agree.
Yeah, and the best kind of, I can think of a lot of examples, but I think one of the best ones is near the end, the reveal that there's a replicant army about to take over or about to kind of fight back. Mm-hmm. It could seem so Matrix Revolutions, you know what I mean? It could feel really unwieldy and big, and trying to ratchet up the numbers in order to ratchet up the emotion, which rarely works, and it's something we've talked about being a problem in a lot of these Marvel movies. That reveal of this hidden underground army only functions to make Kay realize that he's not the child that he's been looking for, right? Mm-hmm. That there is this big turn, or what could be a big turn in the narrative, and lead right into the set piece. But it's all of these people who show up, and I'll use the term people loosely throughout this.
Yeah. Oh, of course.
all of these new characters that show up only service our immediate plot instead of volume for the sake of volume.
Yes, I agree entirely. And that is one of the things that I was continually impressed by watching this movie the first time, is that it was a super expensive action movie that didn't really have a lot of action. And when it did have action, it was relatively small, you know, like the climax of the movie is basically a one-on-one fight scene, you know?
Yeah.
And that was fantastic.
Yeah. And I think that a lot of the things that Villeneuve has done, I mean, specifically Sicario, I think that one scene that we talked about loving so much in that is the scene at the border where they're stuck in the car. And I think that you can shoot that sequence in a way where it is a bigger kind of all-out action scene, or you can shoot that in a way where you relate more to our protagonist and see what she sees and feel stuck where she is, and have the sound design kind of come from all around her instead of just kind of maximum right down the middle volume. And I think that's one of the things that I enjoy that he brought to this, is that ability to tell this huge story. I mean, the blackout is the result of a dirty bomb that, you know, kind of reconfigured all of society and shook up so much. But it's just sort of this plot point that makes his search for this, for a certain truth much more inconvenient than earth shattering.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, and to go back to what you were saying about Sicario and Denis Villeneuve's take on action, is that he's way more interested in tension than actual action and or action sequences. You know, he's interested in the build up to it. It's like what we always say about sex scenes. Once you actually get to the sex part of things, it's pretty rote. it's more or less the same. But it's the build up to that where you get elements of character, and it's the same thing with action sequences. You know, if you can build tension better, it just makes the action sequence, despite being a relatively small one, just feel more more intense and more engaging.
Yeah, absolutely. And so do you feel that he, and I'd open this up to Beyond Villeneuve, but to Deakins and Dennis Glassner, is that the production designer? Gassner?
I couldn't tell you. I stopped reading the credits after the DP.
Okay. And our boy Hans Zimmer. Do you feel that they were kind of able to impose their own talents and ideas on this? Or do you think that they were focused too much on giving us something that we're already kind of used to in the first Blade Runner?
I would say I'm kind of paraphrasing Denis Villeneuve, but this was something I definitely noticed, is that it sounds like the sounds of Blade Runner are very present. I think the look is totally different. it's a very clean movie for the most part when you're not in Las Vegas, which is, I mean, obviously a deliberate choice. Like they wanted Deckard's lair slash casino to be like the remnants of the movie that we have in our minds, right? So there, the production design is very cluttered because the first Blade Runner is a very cluttered movie. That clutter, for the most part, doesn't exist so much in K scenes in LA. You know, like you look at Robin Wright, her office. It's like kind of cluttered, but still cluttered in this very sort of clean way. And I don't know, it felt less busy, the production design. And I feel like what Roger Deakins did was certainly very Blade Runner inspired. But again, the crispness of the cinematography in this movie is like incomparable. And Blade Runner, the first Blade Runner, has always felt a little dirty to me, a little grimy. Like, I don't know how many, I'm sure fog machines were used in Blade Runner 2049, but like literally everybody on the crew in the first Blade Runner was walking around with a fog machine, you know? Like, so it just doesn't feel very Blade Runner-y visually, which I thought was a cool choice, you know?
Yeah, and on that note, I think it's just much less of a noir than Blade Runner.
Yeah, that's a good way to describe it.
And not just in the amount of fog. I think that not that Gosling is super emotive throughout this entire movie, because obviously that's not true, and is kind of what we've come to expect from him, and it ends up he's good at it, so that's quite all right. But it seemed like Harrison Ford in Blade Runner plays it more like the 40s, 50s kind of quiet, hard-boiled gumshoe of noir that we know than we see from Gosling in 2049.
Yeah, for sure. Like, I think, and also just to tie into that point, like, I feel like there are probably a lot of shadows in Blade Runner, and in 2049, those shadows have been replaced with silhouettes, you know? And shadows, a key marking of noir cinematography as well.
Right.
Yeah,
and it's it's still hard to think of this as entirely separate from that, though. Even just seeing in the first commercials and trailers of this, that that scene of Kay walking kind of on the, I guess it's just a bit of a bridge, kind of seems catwalky, but then we have the giant colored hologram speaking to him that we now later know as Joy. Mm-hmm. I saw that, and it was something, it seemed updated, but it just seems so fitting of that old universe of Blade Runner. And there's tons of things like that.
Yeah, I mean, Atari is still a thriving company in 2049, apparently.
Yeah, that's right.
That shot's amazing, though. Anyway, continue.
Yeah, no, that shot's great.
Sorry, let's not point out which shots we think are amazing, because we'll be here until Tuesday.
No, that one's so good. And even outside of context, you know, not knowing that this character does mean something to him within the narrative, it was just kind of this very odd but powerful but dark but sexual but bright image that I think just that combination of things that we got from the first Blade Runner coming back in a fresh enough way. And I would kind of say the same about one of my favorite scenes in the movie, which is in Las Vegas as the Elvis hologram is kind of putting on its show but not doing a good job, and they're fighting through it, but again, it's not a normal fight scene either. It was just one of those ones that seemed so very fitting for this universe, but not derivative and not just a retread.
Yeah, I get that entirely. And I mean, I think everybody points to that scene as one that they like a lot.
Yeah,
because it's pretty fantastic.
Any other particular standouts for you, or shots even?
Ooh. I mean, there's one shot we'll talk about, but I don't know. I just feel like it's the whole. No. I'm just saying no, because
because then you'll talk for 2.5
yeah.
hours.
You can thank me later. Thank me now and later for this. But yeah, Roger Deakins is the best. I will say one moment that I love, a nice action movie moment that I love, and this is also so Denis Villeneuve, because we would have talked about this in the Sicario podcast for sure, because Denis Villeneuve loves cutting away to extreme close-ups of details of scenes. The pot boiling in the middle of Kay's conversation with Batista at the beginning of the movie is a perfect example. And later in that scene, when Kay and I forget his name, Sapper, is that his name?
Yeah, Sapper Morton.
Yeah, are fighting. You get the cut to the other side of the wall, and it's just yeah. the close up of the wall moving. That's awesome. And so Denis Villeneuve. You know, it's like this is a detail of a scene that's happening that literally no other director would think of putting in this movie.
Yeah, and so that is it anything like thematic or symbolic, but or is it just that kind of visual idea to go somewhere else and not even show us the action or barely show us the action, but still have it so clear what's happening?
I think if I were to guess why Denis Villeneuve does those shots, and I'm including this, like his other movies in this, is that I think it's part of that sort of imperceptible hold he can have over you over the course of the movie. Like, because what I've described when talking about Blade Runner, that 100% happened the first time I saw Arrival in a theater full of 1,000 people that were walking out and just like, what the hell did I just see? Like, what happened to me? We were so entranced, and I remember it happening with Sicario as well. That hold he has on you, I think it's just because you feel like you're in an environment, you know? And that's what those shots are to me. They are him saying, here's another part of this environment you 100% didn't think of, but is a part of this. You know, the pot boiling on the stove, even though that's a more notable moment because Gosling actually does draw attention to that. But I just think it's a part of that hold that Villeneuve wants to have over his audience. Just that sort of trance.
And that's what makes it more of an experiential viewing, because it's not... it's not so much this laneway that's been carved out by so many other things that you kind of just get on the ride and go through the motions. But, you know, just for that wall example, you're literally taking a different approach. Like you've got a different angle on this thing that you now have more of a 360 degree impression of it, not necessarily a visual style, but all the just a deeper dive into all the ramifications of it, or all the different angles of something.
Yeah, exactly.
Okay.
Yeah.
I can get down with that.
that's good news. I was worried we were going to fight for a second, that one of us was going to have to throw the other one through a wall.
Yeah, he wasn't a very good cop in that moment, eh?
I don't know. I think it's just sort of like, well, I mean... Let's talk about the ethics of policing in this movie then, you know? Yeah. Well, I don't actually want to do it. He's not really, he's not a cop so much as he is a murderer. And, I mean, insert your own thoughts about the police, any police force here, but like, he's a murderer. You know, that's his job. He is a professional murderer. He happens to have to do some pretty good detecting to lead up to the murder, but if somebody's not willing to submit to what he has been told he has to do, then he will murder them.
Right.
And then if they submit to what he has to do and they are a replicant, he will murder them.
Yeah. And so what did you think of the idea of, I mean, I think one of the central questions about Blade Runner, even though I think a lot of people say it doesn't really matter about this, it's more the experience and the atmosphere that movie creates, but one of the central things that's talked about so much is Deckard's status as a replicant or not.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think coming into this, we were wondering the same thing about this version of Deckard, if it would be clear, and whatever character that we were going to meet, which ended up being Kay. And it seems like they quickly made it clear that he was a replicant, and then toyed with the idea that he wasn't. And did you think, I mean, that seems to be the central question, but it's still not as central
yeah.
to people's appreciation of the movie. Do you think that still holds for this one?
I think yes. I think it I think the way they handled it was like the best possible way. Like, I love it so much.
Like, we're doing something else here.
Yeah, exactly. But also, like, we're still gonna give you ideas, you know, like we're gonna talk around it, and because we know you're thinking about it, but we are 100% not gonna give you the answer you think you might want, which I think is a great move. I mean, I think we both are firmly on the side of he is a replicant, if only because I don't think Blade Runner is a very interesting movie if he's human. So I don't know. That's sort of always the take I've had on it. But I really, really love that 2049 did not really, they found a workaround for it. Yeah. Like, we could still have Harrison Ford in the movie without really answering the question.
Okay.
Yeah. What about you?
I really enjoyed the idea of them addressing it as soon as possible and then kind of putting it into the background.
Yeah, yeah, exactly.
And I guess one of the things I was trying to get to when I was saying that that's not the main idea is it's not a whodunit what is it? I don't even know what the replicant version of that is, but it seems that it is this this character arc that we're seeing, right? It's about a progression that we see in this character, whether or not he was made in a factory or was born out of a human womb, that he begins to assert free will, and that by doing this grand gesture in the end, he's kind of self-actualized no matter what the true status of his origin is. And I mean, K/Joe by this.
Yeah. Okay. I was going to say at the end, I started to get a little confused. But yes. Yeah, I agree. And I will say I find K way more interesting than I have ever found Deckard as a character. So I think if only for that, like props to the whole 2049 team, you know?
Yeah,
because I think he I don't know. I just feel like maybe there's something about just how I/society views Harrison Ford as just Harrison Ford. Although I guess Gosling is Gosling too, but just I don't know. There was never anything all that interesting about Deckard himself, other than the question: is he a human or is he a replicant? Whereas I think you get more character with K in one movie than you get with Deckard in two.
yeah.
And
true.
I think that's really cool.
Even though I think their combined running time over two movies comes out to about equal.
Yeah, probably true. but like, I think the one of the main decisions that, that they seem to make pretty early on, in the making of this movie, and so I watched the original Blade Runner the day before I saw Blade Runner 2049, and I was watching it with my friend Mandy, who hadn't seen it in a while, and or in a long time, and like didn't really remember it that well. She said at the end of the movie, she's like, "The stuff with Roy was really interesting, but I did not find Deckard fascinating at all." And I get that and kind of agree with it. But what this movie very wisely did was put a Deckard story and a Roy story in the same person. And I think that is sort of what the movie really is. It's like K is like the personification of Deckard and Roy wrestling back and forth through the entirety of Blade Runner, but he's doing it all internally. You know, we have this movie's like exterior version of Roy, which is Love. Is that her name?
Yeah,
that's. I was gonna say. I feel like I must be remembering that wrong, but like she is the physically she's the Roy of the movie, but as far as like thematically, Kay is experiencing all of Roy's journey and Deckard simultaneously.
Yeah, and I think that's another point to this movie doing more stuff internally. Not that the first Blade Runner was this movie that just ran through action set pieces, but I think it achieves a bit more of a personal struggle and of a character arc where, as you said, Deckard's his arc is am I?
yes.
Whereas I think there's more to K's.
Yeah, I agree.
And just speaking about Gosling and Harrison Ford as actors, they don't occupy the same space. Like, Gosling is new Harrison Ford, right?
No, God, no. That's not okay. What I meant at all.
I didn't think so either. I had that question written down beforehand.
There is no new Harrison Ford. Harrison Ford is Harrison Ford.
Okay.
Harrison Ford was the new combination of Cary Grant and Humphrey Bogart, but there is no. We're done with Harrison Fords as a society.
Okay. Cute yeah. movie star.
Yeah. Exactly.
Okay. And yeah, it just speaking about the connection of the two of them again as characters, I think it's kind of for the best that it ends up they aren't related. Like, that seems too, let's continue something for the sake of continuing something.
Mm-hmm.
Seems too kind of sequel-y extended universe-y, even though this very much is an extension of that previous story. I did kind of enjoy that because that seems a little too simplistic otherwise.
Oh yeah, for sure. Just like it would have been a real bummer if Gosling was the Christ child, you know, like would have been a huge bummer.
Yeah, and I think that that level of disappointment did not disappoint me. You know what I mean? I think that's good, and it still ended on this positive tone, but it ends with this really bittersweet note that I think pervades the whole movie of self-sacrifice, not you know, not being 100% great. You know, that's what sacrifice is. Good things result from it, but it obviously isn't good for the person that experiences it. And I think we see a little bit of that with Joy. You know, she kind of self-actualizes by limiting herself to one person. You know, she takes herself out of what I'm going to call the cloud, because that's what it is. You know, she allows herself the ability to die because it's the only thing that can make her gestures meaningful when she moves entirely into the emanator device.
Yeah. Yeah. For sure.
Okay, what's better, the baseline test or the Voight Kampff test?
Baseline.
Okay, any reason?
Roger Deakins shot it. No, that first baseline test scene is amazing. Just because
I think it's great.
No, I don't think you're disagreeing with me. Sorry, what is your answer to that question? And then I will continue my point.
I don't know. I do love the old, like, I love the look of the old Voight Kampff machine.
Mm-hmm.
And I do enjoy the first Voight Kampff test and how it opens the movie and how you have no idea what's going on. And how it's so weird, but that's kind of what the first one. If these were two were switched, I would obviously say that about the first one, about the baseline test as well, right? Mm-hmm. It's we've already kind of lost the idea of. I know it's not a replicant test, but these intense kind of biorhythmic tests that people have to go through within this universe. But yeah, I think that the first time they go through that in this one is just very jarring in a way that the Voight Kampff test isn't jarring until the very end, the first time we go through it.
Yeah, exactly, because the baseline test, it's a two-shot scene. There's the one camera behind, or the first one, there's the one camera behind Gosling that's doing that slow classic Villeneuve push-in on the whatever machine camera thing is that's looking at Kay, and it's just this voice going so loud and getting louder, and there's this hum that's coming up in the mix as well. And then just at the very end, you get the cut to Kay with the door behind him. And it's just so, like, I don't know, it just sucks you in, and it's so intense. And I don't know, it just sort of, I tensed up, like, when I saw it. And I just think it's a, like, that's an action scene in this movie to me, you know, because it made me physically feel something.
Yeah, you're trying to relate, but you're also trying to understand what's happening. You're trying to hear everything. Yeah, it's just very unsettling and intense and well put together.
Yeah, yeah, for sure. Interlink.
I'll make a quick note of my disappointment at the lack of the word enhance in this movie, despite all the opportunities
that
to have it.
That's another way this movie is a fantastic departure from the original.
That those scenes make a bit more sense.
Yeah, exactly. Well, I mean, while we're on the topic of the baseline test, because the second shot of that sequence, when we cut cut to basically the camera's point of view, the baseline test camera's point of view, we've got a door right behind Kay. And one of the things I found so interesting about this movie, one, this movie, like, for a blockbuster, most artful directing of a blockbuster that I can think of off the top of my head. It's unbelievable. But, yeah, like, the framing choices and everything. And the one thing that I noticed that is so pervasive throughout the movie, and this happens, I said this to you in an email, I would be surprised if this wasn't, like, the case in 80% of his scenes, but anytime Kay is indoors, and he's like the focus of the frame, there is a doorway or a window or some sort of thing that he can pass through framed behind him. Like, like, it's amazing how frequent this is. And to the point where, that isn't the case a lot of the times with other characters. There is the stuff with Sapper at the beginning where, if I remember correctly, God, I mean, I'm sure you remember Kay is right under the window, because there's that very, very beautiful 60% total darkness shot,
yeah,
when Sapper walks into his kitchen, and then Sapper's underneath the other window. And that, I think that pairing is supposed to be because they're both replicants. Then you get him with Joshi in Kay's apartment. And Kay, when he is framed, he is in his doorway, right? When we're in the close-up of him, flip the camera over to Joshi, and there's a matching, like, black tile behind Joshi's head, but it doesn't, like, extend further than her head. Like, it's a very, it's like the same sort of shape behind her, but it's a more limited sort of version of it. And yeah, it's like Kay has a doorway, but Joshi is who she is because she's human. Later in the movie, and this will continue to further my point, that Deckard is a replicant. Deckard is framed so much the same way when he is in the movie. Very frequently, when he is indoors, he is framed in a doorway. And I think that's supposed to maybe point us to the idea that he's a replicant. But also, just in general, I just found the dedication of that was amazing. And part of it is, like, in some of the set designs, it's easy, like, the room they spend so much of their time in Vegas is mostly glass. So that one kind of makes things easier. But I don't know, it's just the level of dedication there is amazing.
Yeah, and like, yeah, this idea of borders and boundaries to be crossed is one that's obviously present throughout this movie, not just in the visual style too, right?
No, exactly. I think the one of the most important lines of the movie is when Joshi says, the world is built in a wall that separates kind. Tell either side there's a wall, or there's no wall. Sorry, I'll say it again. Tell either side there's no wall, you've bought a war or a slaughter. And it should be noted that she is framed in her office looking out the window, and the camera is shooting inside through a window that is just coated with rain when she says that. And the use of walls throughout this movie is so, so prevalent. And I think, like, because so much about, I think, of what people like about Blade Runner is the sort of discussion of what does it mean to have a soul. And I think this Blade Runner 2049 actually kind of gives a thesis on that. And I think we sort of see Kay gain a soul over the course of the movie. And it's not necessarily the actions themselves. It's just him realizing that he has agency, right? He starts to think for himself. Like, early on in the movie, we get, I think it's that same scene as the You've Bought a War scene, where Joshi says, are you disobeying an order? And he says, I wasn't aware that's an option. And it's sort of like the seeds of maybe I can do things that I'm not told to do are being planted in his mind. And you also see that with Joy as well, right? Like, she actively, like, she wants to be removed from this place, or this, I don't know, this weird, like, ceiling wand that she is kind of attached to. So she wants a tiny pocket wand that she's kind of attached to instead. But, like, that is her equivalent of gaining agency. And what does that allow her to do eventually? Right before she dies, she's able to say, I love you, which is the I think, you know, one of the most like human things that we would think of, you know, the concept of feeling love. And I think the way the movie traces that through Joy is really interesting. And I think the way that it shows Kay learning that is really interesting as well, because that's why he's framed with all these windows and doorways. It's that he's always surrounded by these passageways that he can move through and continue on a journey on. He just doesn't realize that that door is unlocked, you know?
Yeah, and...
or that he can jump through the wall, you know?
Yeah, and now we'll get to... I mean, we had to get to it eventually, but Jared Leto.
Around here, we pronounce it the great Jared Leto.
No, but just his character, similar to the way Tyrell ended up without Vision. He plays a blind character, Nyander, who can't see anything. You know, I think there's this idea that he can't see the walls. He exists in this very wide open room, these massive rooms with no borders and no delineations present. You know, obviously they have walls, but they never frame people in this way. They never separate people, and there's always this shimmering water. You know, it's this notion of either there are no walls, and even the floor, even the things that we do have that's kind of separate spaces, have this feeling of fluidity, and you never get shots where you can't see that there's water in this room, and that there's this constant motion. And he's a character spending time trying to get away from these separations, and the world has said and illegalized more replicants, but he doesn't permit that boundary to continue to impose on him. He's just in the business of doing more and more, regardless of what walls metaphorically have been placed around his vision. And he wants to get to more planets, he wants to get to more worlds, he wants to do more and more things. And there might not be literal walls in his way, but he still wants to break them down any way he can.
Yeah, absolutely.
And now we don't have to talk about Jared Leto
anymore. Oh, thank God we did it. I will say, I love one more thing I love about this movie. Maybe the only thing I love about Jared Leto. This movie doesn't feature a scene with Ryan Gosling and Jared Leto together, which I think is kind of interesting. I mean, Jared Leto only has like two scenes. Thank you, Denis. I don't know. I just found that interesting. Because you, like... And going into this movie, anybody with any sort of reasonable knowledge of this movie would anticipate a big, like, I yell my opinions at you, Ryan Gosling scene. And then Ryan Gosling, depending on how much you know about replicants, either yells back or just stands stoically and leaves.
Yeah, but I mean, just in the way that we've talked about this kind of sidestepping a lot of the blockbuster tropes.
Yeah.
You have your protagonist and you have your villain. You know, there is always inevitably going to be the showdown with the big bad, and you know, something about our protagonist that makes him the one we like will allow him to best the villain. And this is avoided. You know, there is that confrontation with love, but just another way that this kind of subverts those expectations.
Yeah, for sure. There is we've talked about it a little bit. There is a real idea of twins and pairs in this movie. One of the sadnesses I have about this podcast is that we're doing it when I can't like watch it at home and take a hilarious amount of notes like I have for some other movies where the craft is the level of craftsmanship is so high. And like just the pairing of the shot, you know, something like where Gosling is rinsing off, or Kay is rinsing off Sapper's eyeball at the beginning. I forget the matching shot of it later, but there's a character where we see that same sort of close-up of their hands holding something. I mean, even just Sapper and Kay are kind of pairs, you know, they're both replicants sort of thing. Obviously, Kay and... I actually don't even remember his sister's name or his clone's name. Sorry, he is the clone. Dream Lady.
Dr. Dream Lady.
Dr. Dream Lady. MD. Thursdays on NBC. sounded like a fake 30 Rock promo. Obviously... him and her. And also, there's a little bit of the Roy... Roy and Love comparison, you know, just like Sapper and Brian James's character, the guy from the very beginning of Blade Runner. There's just a real pairing of, I don't know, and it just sort of feels like everything sort of has its reflection, and there are examples of this in the cinematography as well. The one that really sticks out to me is the one right before Kay finds out that he's not the chosen one, sort of thing. And you get that shot, it's this very silhouette shot of the woman he's talking to, and there's like a small window above them, and then it's reflected perfectly on the water on the floor below them, and that shot is like symmetrical horizontally and vertically, like it's unbelievable. And there are so many good shots like that throughout this movie, and I don't know, I just sort of found the idea of pairs continuing to exist being very interesting, and that's actually something that has continued throughout Villeneuve's work. Sicario is probably the best example. Brolin and Benicio, sort of two of a kind, different yeah. versions of the same thing. Prisoners, you've got Hugh Jackman and Terrence Howard's character going through the exact same situation but approaching it in different ways, and I just thought that was interesting that in a blockbuster movie, this auteur is still able to carry something that he is very interested in through. Yeah.
Yeah. No, and that's what I wanted about. Like, that's what I thought would make us happy about directors that we like, kind of getting involved with these big budget things, is being able to inject what they've made is clearly important to them and their previous works, not just present, but very much related to what people liked about the original product to begin with.
Yeah, exactly. Like the company that made this movie, their company was made on trusting people that know how to make movies, like directors. Whereas something like Warner Brothers, over a certain amount of time, they start to figure out that, or studios famously have sort of started to run themselves like theme park rides, like they're selling theme park rides, you know? I think one of the studio heads was actually the head of Six Flags at one point. Whereas like Alcon Entertainment, I just like countless DVD rentals had started with that Alcon Entertainment indie production logo, you know? And they're just people that trust filmmakers that decided, hey, let's try a blockbuster. Let's trust this filmmaker. And it's really amazing to see a scale like this.
Yeah.
Another thing I feel like we skipped over with the discussion of Wall is the way this movie treats class, because I find it interesting that again, the wall between classes, I think you could very easily say Kay is of a class, Joshi is an upper class, you know. Joshi tells yeah. Kay what to do. Wallace obviously is more Joshi than Kay, just like Love is more Kay than Joshi. And I found it interesting that, and this is not something that I came up with by myself, I was just reading a bunch about cyberpunk and specifically the way Blade Runner uses cyberpunk. And I just have a question. Why are there like very few to little minorities in this world where Japanese is also like the secondary text on everything that's pretty much everything that's printed out in this movie? Like all of Kay's forms and everything. Like, it just feels weird to me that the language is so prevalent, but the people are not. Yeah.
Yeah, no, I understand that. And especially because that's not true in the first one, which takes place in the same world.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I've seen, I saw that, I don't know, criticism as well, or at least that point being made. And yeah, I think it was something that was present in the first one, was, you know, him ordering noodles and not being able to speak the same language, Deckard, I mean.
Two, four. Yeah, exactly. I love the way he says that. It's so funny.
And I don't want this to come off like, if this is just a case of whitewashing a certain race out of the movie, that it's okay, because I think that the people making this are more thoughtful than that. And are better people than that, I'm guessing. But these aren't people that I know personally, so I can't really attest to that. But I think it's just, and I don't know if this is what they would thought of, but this is just where I go with it, is just that there's this idea that there's no guiding principle really in charge. Like I think the English language is this mishmash of other languages, and you know, we didn't get here with any forethought. It just ended up being ease of pronunciation and loan words and all these things that ended up why English is such a mess and such a hard language to learn, if it's not your first language. And I think it's just this idea that certain things stick, and there is no greater kind of hand that forces these things to go the right way. And like, even just thinking about this now, I look down and there's like the QWERTY keyboard. It's just, it's designed that way, not for optimal use, but because the letters got arranged that way, because the way that it's designed for optimal use would jam the bars on a typewriter. So they had to do this one where you can't type as quickly as possible because the mechanics of the machine just wouldn't be able to keep up with it. And it's just what we learned with, so there's no real line in the sand where we can just reassess this idea and fix it. And even in this scenario, in this world where we have this blackout that seems like this reset, that there is this idea that things just continue down a path, and that's why it's so important to kind of analyze every decision, because there's no, you know, there's no backtracking it, and things continue to go this way. And you know, Adam Smith talking about the invisible hand of capitalism, meaning every, like, if everyone pursues their own goals, things are going to work out the best for everybody. It doesn't really work out, you know. I'm not suggesting a better idea than capitalism, but yeah. I think it's kind of come to be shown that it's not the perfect system. And that even with political leaders and things like this who might try to guide you the certain way, or I think it's just the most true with technology, which is why I use the keyboard example off the top, is that something happens and then that snowballs. And that's what I kind of see in this use of language, that it made sense for a time and then it continues. The way that having replicants at the time made sense, but then you know, there's this rebellion and they started killing people in the off world, and there's just this linear progression to things that we're always caught in. And I think that's what's one of the things that's interesting about dystopian fiction, is that you look at it and you can't see all the pieces that would have led to it, but it's not so incredibly difficult to perceive this happening, even though it's so significantly different than the world is now, and something so much more undesirable than the way things are now. It's this idea of a straight line and never really being able to predict the future of things, but just kind of rolling with the punches as they come. And I, as I said, I don't think that's what went through their minds thinking it, but when that's one of the great things about having this lived in world that other movies do, obviously, but it kind of allows your mind to wander to these things. And when you have a world that's busy but thought out and a complete vision and something, these unique characteristics that let you think about and pacing that allows your mind to wander and isn't just obsessed with the next explosion, that you can inject these ideas. And when you say you like the first Blade Runner as much as you choose to like the first Blade Runner, that being true of everybody, I think that applies to movies like this, that when they're put together well enough that they're engaging, but they leave breathing space for you to bring your own ideas to it, that's when it can really achieve something great.
Yeah, for sure. And I think, speaking to your point, I think I think it also somehow works as like an even darker version of the future than you know, even just the look of the movie and the environmental world that we're in this movie, where it's snowing in Los Angeles in June. Is that like everybody at the top of the world is still white, you know? And like, yeah. When you think about how many of these characters are replicants who were made, right? It's sort of like, it's not that different from a studio head casting a movie. The studio head will just go with what they have figured out works before, you know? And it's not that hard to imagine someone like, say, Wallace or Tyrell just sort of being like, oh, I'm making a person. What should that person look like? Well, I'm a white male, so just subconsciously you're going to think this person's a white male. I'm going to design this person I'm going to have him look like Ryan Gosling, because of course, you know, when you're able to design a white human male, you're probably going to pick someone like Ryan Gosling. And I just sort of think that somehow makes it so much even more dark version of the future, in that like none of the main characters in this movie are minorities. And the fact that all the positions of power in this movie are held by white people. I think it's just so dark. It's so dark. You know, and also just on a smaller note, that people like Barkhad Abdi, despite being a fantastic actor, can't get another goddamn role, you know.
Yeah.
it's bonkers that we have not seen Barkhad Abdi in something post Captain Phillips. And I know he was in, I think he was in either This Is 40 or Trainwreck and got cut out, but it's just crazy to me, just because he's obviously so fantastic in Captain Phillips. He is fantastic in this movie in a very small, very fun scene. But it's just, I think that's something that I think whitewashing implies something that's conscious. And I think this movie, I don't think you can call it whitewashing, because I don't think Denis Villeneuve was like, no, this person has to be played by a white man, you know? I just think it's sort of like a subconscious sort of thing. And that 2049 still projects this image of subconscious whiteness running society, I think is just adds an extra level of darkness to the
the last time I saw Abdi was at the Oscars. Think of that.
Yeah, exactly, that makes sense. Well, now I'm sad. So we started talking about the Dreamweaver, Dr. Dreamweaver MD, Thursdays on NBC. Or Dreammaker.
Dr. Anna Stelling.
Okay, thank you. Thoughts, I suppose. I don't know. What do you think about that character?
I think that her, like, just in a vacuum, watching the sequence of her, I don't know, engineer that memory of a birthday party had to be one of my favorite parts of this movie. And was just great visually and extremely engaging, and everything from her little handheld device to her formulating this in the foreground and having K off in the distance, and it what that means for him and his distance from these memories that may or may not be his. I think it all looked perfect and was the exact kind of thing I was hoping for from Blade Runner 2049. It's obviously not what you want for 2.5 hours. You can't make a whole movie of that. But if we're going to talk about the aesthetic of the first one, being different enough but still fitting in with that world and utilizing today's technology and it looking pretty much perfect, I think that's one of the things I would point to. And then we get the added narrative bonus of, you know, what that means, and then reflecting on that, knowing what Kay knows by the end of the story, and again that distance between him and the memory. That sequence alone is one of my favorites.
And all the best memories are hers is the saddest line in the world. Like, that's so sad.
Yeah, exactly. And that's what I mean by knowing what we know at the time, it's good, and that, well, it's better than good at the time, and then to have this extra layer onto it once we know everything, is pretty heartbreaking.
Yeah, for sure. And just going back to the scene, the birthday cake scene, the introduction of that scene, I'm sure you remember, is it's sort of like in a jungle and she's changing bugs and whatnot, insects and whatnot. So Roger Deakins doesn't really like lens flares. In that sequence, there's a lens flare coming from the sky, and it's like she's creating a memory, and lens flares are generally there to sort of add an extra element of pop to an image. And I think Deakins is just such like a perfectionist that he refuses to let flares exist. But that there is one flare in this movie and it exists in a fabricated dream is so cool to me. I don't know. I just think that's such a small element of craft, and that it's like, it's pretty center framed and is the standard star flare that specifically Emmanuel Lubezki is known for using very frequently, who is probably the closest closest rival Mr. Deakins has. I just found that very entertaining and very cool.
Mm-hmm. And the transition into that scene as well.
Oh, yeah.
This movie that's it's black and gray and like a burnt out red and you know, just not the most, I mean, simultaneously the least and most aesthetically pleasing aesthetic to have this bit stand out and for your mind to kind of keep up with it and to have that edifice crumble. You know, obviously this, a place this beautiful doesn't exist in the world of Blade Runner 2049 anymore. And the way that we can relate with Kay, you know, that he's not as interested in that image as we are, but to have this thing that looks so beautiful and so gorgeous and then to see that it's been merely manipulated and then to know and to have that taken away from the viewer and to never see anything like that again, kind of puts us in his shoes with having his memories taken as well.
Yeah, absolutely. And again, there's a wall between between her and everybody that comes to visit her. It's a glass wall, but it's still a wall. And
and you can always see her reflection and to never let you forget that there is this distance between them too, right?
Well, also, yeah, exactly. And also, whenever we're seeing shots of her, you can see a little bit of a reflection of Kay over top of her. And I just think that's such a small element. Like when you're watching the first movie, obviously that doesn't mean anything. It looks more like a mistake than anything. When you're watching it the first time, when you're watching 2049 the first time, when you're watching the 1982 version and are somehow transported to this scene that was shot in 2017. Just that tiny element that almost looks like a mistake. And then you find out at the end of the movie and you're just like, oh, God damn it, Denis. You did it again. You little bastard. And just that, like, what is Kay? He's a reflection of this character, you know? And, like, that's so fantastic and so subtle. And this is a $150 million movie where that stuff is happening, and it's amazing. And this will never happen again.
No, it won't.
Well. All the best memories were hers. yeah. Now I'm sad again.
I don't know what to do about that. Yeah. I think it's supposed to be that way.
Yeah. So I just want to talk about the ending of this movie. I think the ending of this movie is so... It's okay, it's weird because, again, I don't care that much about Deckard. In general, like I never really did in the first movie. It was, again, it was the question that you posed 8 times earlier. And so, like, the last shot of the movie, I have some thoughts on it, but I wasn't super attached to it. The scene of Kay talking to Deckard asking him, why are you doing this? Yada, yada, yada. And then he lies in the snow. That sequence is so beautiful. And it's like they made a sequence, and again, more Blade Runner than Blade Runner, they made a sequence that felt how people talk about the Tears and Rain sequence, which is something I have never really loved. Like, yeah, that speech has never been my thing, and that seems to be, like, the best part of Blade Runner to some people.
Yeah, just like, which I've been reminded of while reviewing this movie and people talking about how much that meant to them, and maybe we just missed it by a little bit, but... It's always just been so clunky to us.
No, it's high school poetry is what it is. It's Rutger Hauer improvised poetry, which is exactly what it is. So again, more Blade Runner than Blade Runner. This is the piece of score on the 2049 soundtrack for that scene is called Tears and Rain. It's just a different kind of precipitation as Kay dies. But it's actually, like, really beautiful. And then you get the cut to the snow, the close-up of the snow in her hand. Like, she is just creating this memory for him. And the fact that just those two things so close together. The first time I saw this movie, when they cut to the close-up of that hand with the snow, I got so excited. And, like... And again, that type of excitement can come from something that's thematic, right? Like, I'm just getting sucked into this sequence that that scene does go on for longer than that scene would go on and go on for in most movies. And you just sort of get caught in this sort of trance, and then it just gets flipped on its head. You know, just as you're getting comfortable, you're like, oh, that's not real. And just like the origami unicorn at the end of the first Blade Runner, it just sort of basically yells a question at you at the end of the movie. It's like, was any of this real? You know, and there's always the lurking question of the first shot, the eye, like, whose eye are we seeing? You know, what vision are we seeing? And is any of what we're actually seeing real? And I don't know. I just found it such a wonderful moment of filmmaking.
Yeah. And that, is it the question, as you say, like, for it to, is it a bit of Inception? Is it a bit of this idea that things are fine, like, things have finally resolved in a way that seems kind of Hollywoody, like, it kind of plays your heartstrings a little bit, and that there's this bit of joy, and then it very quickly instead might take it all away from you, depends on how you feel?
Yes. Yeah, I think so. And also, it just sort of hits in more of a more potent way than, because again, like, I realized walking home from the movie that I'm like, this is the origami unicorn, but like, the origami unicorn at the end of Blade Runner never really did that much for me, you know. And I think it's just because in the first Blade Runner, it comes right after the tears and rain sequence. In second Blade Runner, that moment comes right after the tears and snow sequence, you know. And it's just, you've been held in this potential fake memory, you know. And it's just sort of, it puts you right in Kay's shoes. I think that's what it is.
Yeah.
It's you realizing that your memory of the horse isn't real, and that maybe everything you've ever done is a lie. And yeah, that the movie has been going on for, according to people that hate the movie, a lifetime. it really packs a punch.
Yeah, no, it's just that idea that if you, no matter how you felt about the things leading up to it in the first Blade Runner, it's very much a pull the rug out from you sort of moment. And if you're just on the floor laughing about the tears of rain speech, it doesn't matter that you've had the rug pulled out from under you. But if you're kind of standing there in awe of the snow sequence, and then the rug pulls out from under you, there's just a lot more falling and a harsher realization of the ground in that scenario.
Yeah, and when she says, as Deckard walks in, like, hold on, I'm almost finished, or some equivalent of that, like, it's just like, he's dying, and I'm just, I don't know, I'm making this last moment for him. I don't know, it's just, it's simultaneously so beautiful and so sad.
Yeah. And that's Blade Runner.
Well, and then, I mean, what's the last shot of the movie? It's Deckard walking up to one of the many walls that we have seen and putting his hand on it, like he's actually making an action towards one of the walls. We've seen him and Kay as well. One thing we didn't mention is that when Kay goes home, he sits in front of his window and just stares out of it while eating his meal. Just a very aspirational thing. But Deckard and Kay both framed against walls and windows and all these things you can pass through, and what they do is continue passing through these things, these doorways and everything, and the end of the movie is Deckard finding something you're not supposed to be able to pass through. And I think the key resolution of the movie is that Deckard finally wants to pass through this, and he finally wants to actually see his daughter, and
seemingly will be able to.
Yeah, exactly. You know, he says sometimes to love somebody you've got to be able to walk away or something like that. He says that in Vegas, and but now, you know, he walked away through a door, and now he can walk back through a door and then kick through a wall, you know, to see his daughter. But maybe that's why the music's so loud during the end credits, is that he's gotten out a sledgehammer and it's just going through that glass wall.
That sounds like the most reasonable explanation.
Yeah, exactly. Like tears in glass shards of rain. Oh, it gets really, like, absurdly comedic in the deleted scenes. So thank you for listening to The MacGuffin Man. Be sure to check back next week when we'll already have talked about Dazed and Confused and Everybody Wants Them.